You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. With his latest book, Monsters of the Tar Heel State, David Weatherly has again brought us another fantastic collection of cryptids, legends, and witness encounters from across North Carolina. My first introduction into the strange cryptids of North Carolina was discovering the story of the infamous Beast of Bladenborough through a Monster Quest episode that covered a spate of modern encounters around the town of Bolivia just after the turn of the century, which parallels the Bladenborough case. North Carolina certainly seems to be the stomping ground for something that likes to take domestic animals of all shapes and sizes every few years. Also on this episode of Mysteries and Monsters, we will dive into the mysterious Black Panthers of the Carolinas, another creature dismissed as either misidentification, bobcats, or even Labradors. Can hundreds of witnesses really all be wrong? For some, the number of Bigfoot encounters in the Tar Heel State may also be surprising, yet the reports go all the way back to the days of the Cherokee. We meet Nobby, the local Bigfoot, dearly loved by the residents. Michael Green, a man who allegedly caught thermal footage of a Bigfoot. And the curious case of Casey Hathaway and the bear that allegedly saved his life. A big thank you as always to David for his time, conversation and knowledge. And the links to the Bigfoot footage we mention in the show will be in the show notes. As always, you can support the show by signing up to Patreon in the show notes for $4 a month for early access and bonus content. We're across all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters YouTube channel, and you can find our website at mysteriesandmonsters.com. As always, artwork for the show by my brother, Dean Bestall. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So, before we join David, let's hear an infamous 911 call regarding one of the sightings of Nobby from a gentleman called Tim Peeler, who the media didn't treat so kindly. Clearly, Tim had a very chilling experience.
I don't know if I should have called this in or not, but...
What's going on?
If I have a camera, I took a picture of it.
Took a picture of who?
I don't know what it was. He's walking upright like a man. I would not kill it because I was afraid to. But he went back up the mountain.
Cleveland County 911.
Hello.
Can I help you?
Yes. This is Tim Peeler.
Uh-huh.
You probably have my address.
Yes, sir. What's going on now?
I shined the light on this thing, but I would not shoot it.
Okay, what did it look like?
It looked like a giant ape with a man's face. But I was afraid to kill it. And it made a whistling sound. He was about 9-10 foot tall with real long arms. I go out there, he gets gone. Then I come back in the house, and he gets back there again, and my dogs are just raising heck. Would I get in any trouble if I shot and killed this beast, this animal, or whatever it is? Would I get in any trouble?
I can't answer that question.
If he goes too close to me, I will kill him.
To some, North Carolina may not strike you as a hotbed of cryptozoology, yet
you only have to mention the ferocious Beast of Bladenborough, or the ubiquitous Nobby to those in the know, and a wry smile may appear. The Tar Heel State is full of many a monster. Once again, David Weatherly joins me to take us on a tour of this underrated area in terms of monsters and legends that go back centuries. David, a warm welcome back as always. How are we?
Good day, my friend. It's always good to talk with you.
Oh, likewise. Likewise. Another wonderful addition to your ever-burgeoning state cryptid guide for us all around the world. North Carolina is clearly a state that's dear to your heart, David.
It is indeed. I grew up there, and since you've read the book, you know there are a couple of somewhat personal stories in there of things that I experienced. And, you know, it's funny because a couple of people have asked me, why didn't you do this one first or beforehand? And, honestly, the series has grown very organically and, you know, as a writer, probably more so with fiction than nonfiction, you know, you have a sense of where things are going. But I've noticed in this series, even though it's nonfiction, it's taken on its own direction in some ways. Mm. And that's what led to the sequence that these things have been released. You know, they've kind of been all over the country so far. You know, I've done something in the West. I did Alaska and the Midwest, and now I've hit the South with North Carolina, and didn't do it at first because I wanted to write it carefully, so to speak, since there was a personal element and since there are so many different stories in the state. You know, it turned into a pretty thick volume. In fact, the last three have been pretty hefty size-wise. And there comes a point where, you know, some things just have to be trimmed down. You know, obviously you could do a whole thick book on just Bigfoot sightings in almost any given state.
Yes.
And some of the other stories are extensive too, but North Carolina, of course, has some pretty unique tales, like a lot of the states do, like most of the states do. Mm-hmm. And its big one made the cover was the Beast of Bladenborough, mm-hmm. Sometimes called the Vampire Beast of Bladenborough.
Yes.
But it also covers, you know, a range of other things. It covers, of course, Bigfoot sightings, some water legends, and a range of other strange things that I have uncovered over the years.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that is one of the things about North Carolina, as I referred to in the introduction. I think it's one of those that when you realize just the quality of some of the stories and the monster legends and the encounters from the state, it does surprise me, as we were speaking before we started the interview, David, that the Beast of Bladenborough is one of those that's very well known these days. However, one of the other situations that seems to be going on in North Carolina is the prevalence of Black Panther sightings. And of course, North Carolina is a state, you know, the football team is known as the Carolina Panthers, so it's a state that has a history of panthers. And yet once again we seem to have what would look like hundreds of witnesses who are coming across a creature that allegedly doesn't exist, that everybody must be mistaking for bears, black Labradors, or anything else that other than a black panther, David. And as we said, as you were referring to there, it's a state very close to your heart as someone that grew up there. Are you still surprised whenever we come across this situation that the official line is, no, you're all wrong, you're all seeing things?
Well, that's kind of the, you know, sort of the joke at this point, isn't it? you know, officially they don't exist, so you must be wrong. And these accounts of these Black Panthers in particular, but Panthers in general, they crop up in so many states. And you know, obviously in the United States, we have mountain lions in the West. We do have an eastern big cat. We have the Florida panther, which, mm-hmm. you know, officials say, you know, they're only in the southern part of Florida. So I don't know if the Florida Panthers got the memo that they're not allowed to cross state lines,
mm-hmm.
But apparently it's official, you know, dictate, so they can't possibly be anywhere else. Yet, you know, we get these reports from really all over the country. I've encountered this in so many different states. You hear them out west, you don't think too much about it unless it's something really unusual, like a black panther or, you know, a tiger, you know, a tiger or a leopard or something like that. But when you come to the eastern half of the country and you start hearing these accounts, I ran into plenty of them in the Midwest and all over the South. You hear these accounts in North Carolina, of course. There are, as you stated, hundreds, easily hundreds, maybe even thousands, if you start counting for the fact that there are witnesses who have seen these things multiple times. Mm. There are plenty of people who don't report them because nobody listens, you know, at least no one on the official level. And it's somewhat amusing and frustrating at the same time because, you know, wildlife officials, state officials, so forth say, well, you know, this almost by rote, you know, they just like they're reading from the textbook, you know, well, there are no cougars or panthers in North Carolina. You know, they're extinct. There is no such thing as a black panther. That's the favorite line that these people spout off. And the thing is that they will quickly point out that, you know, there are no documented, quote, black panthers. Now, you'll see some photos if you Google this online, and what you find is that it's typically a jaguar that is black in color, and you can see the patterning on the coat if you look very closely. This is not a cougar or a North American panther that's solid black that you're seeing in these pictures. Yet, this is what countless people are reporting seeing. And I've talked to people who were lifelong outdoorsmen, hunters, you know, people who know every animal that's found in the wild in the state of North Carolina. And these are not guys who are mistaking a house cat for something the size of a panther, you know, or and you hear this handful of explanations from officials, you know, oh, it was a bear, it was a dog, it was a house cat. And it's laughable, honestly. It is, you know, if you're telling someone with that kind of experience, you know. If it's some tourist driving through from New York who, you know, has never been out in the mountains and he says he saw a black panther, well, you might say, okay, well, let's stop and think, you know, and let's consider what's your background. But no, if you're talking about a guy who hunts half of the year every year and has encountered everything you can imagine, he's telling you exactly what he saw, then it becomes pretty fascinating to me. And you say, all right, well, you know, these are accounts and sightings with some validity to them. So the number of these creatures that people are seeing, it's really off the scale. You know, in some portions of western North Carolina, you know, you hear these reports. If you start listening and know who to talk to, you hear these reports all day.
Yeah.
People who spotted them, sometimes while they're out hunting, sometimes, you know, when they were just out, you know, sometimes in a national wildlife area. They're all over the place out there.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the explanation? Well, we're not quite sure.
Well, we know what the explanation is, David. They're not there. Everybody's wrong. I mean, there's a great quote from one of the people that you speak to. I think he's a gentleman called Jim from Asheville, who basically said, well, I didn't bother reporting it because I'm sick to death of people telling me that I don't know what I'm looking at.
Right.
And that seems to be the general thing, as you refer to. When you get people who have spent their entire lives in the woods hunting, either for sport or working in that field in regards to population control, David, for whatever reason, I find it incredible that these people are completely dismissed out of hand, as if these people have no ability to understand what they're looking at. And you wonder, if these people are so bad at at recognizing animals. How on earth have they managed to make a living out of this?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you go into the rural areas of the state and you find people who, you know, they hunt for sustenance and have for generations. So these people, you know, they know what they're doing. They know how to track animals. They you know, understand and recognize the signs. But when it comes to officials, then it's a whole different ballgame because, you know, a lot of these bureaucrats, they don't want to address the idea. They don't want to be the crackpot to a certain degree because, you know, who wants to be the single wildlife official who comes to his boss and says, hey, you know what? I think we got black panthers out in the mountains in North Carolina. They're going to laugh him out of the office, or they're going to, you know, at worst, maybe, you know, demote him or fire him or something like that because it's not acceptable because there's not an excuse or a reason. And, you know, honestly, it's hard to pin down exactly what the reasoning is behind that. I think to a certain degree, some people just don't like the idea of change on an official level and the implications that something like that brings. Mm-hmm. You know, it's in some ways, it's similar to acknowledging Bigfoot. Okay, we're going to acknowledge this animal, this creature that people have been claiming encounters and sightings of for decades. So what does that mean on a governmental level? You know, are we going to regulate it? Are we going to list it as endangered? You know, what does it mean? What is it going to do? And it's the very idea, I think, somewhat sends shockwaves across the bureaucratic levels, so to speak. And that in itself is you know, probably bothersome to them because let's face it, a lot of people are lazy. They don't want the additional work. and a lot of people don't want to take responsibility. You know, as I noted a moment ago, who wants to be that guy,
yeah,
you know, who says, wait a minute here, we really need to look at this, because it's just, it carries so many implications with it.
Yeah. Well, I know many people from all over the US, regardless of which state, wherever this situation turns up, David, there seems to be two trains of thought. One is they don't want the officials don't want to recognize it because we're talking legislation and protection, and certain areas may become fenced off from the public and basically you're going to be stopped from entering these areas you may have gone into for generations. And then the other aspect, of course, is a financial burden on the state, because these would be a remarkable discovery under any circumstances. So I know a lot of people who believe that the officials are just ignoring it until something happens that they can't just dismiss it anymore, are just quite happily just denying it, filibustering people about it, and just moving on and just telling everybody that they're completely wrong.
Well, that's exactly what it is. And, you know, the funny thing is if you sort of reverse the whole concept and you say, well, you know, if you just think for a moment, what would it be like if they suddenly announced that, you know, some particular animal doesn't exist anymore? Mm. You know, let's say, you know, the bobcat, for comparison. Mm. You know, bobcats are all around in the South or in North Carolina. But, you know, how often are bobcats seen? They're solitary creatures. You know, they typically hunt small prey. And, you know, they try to avoid people. But what if all of a sudden the officials started, you know, saying to anyone who saw a bobcat, well, no, that you didn't see a bobcat. That was a chihuahua, you know, or something. And,
yeah,
you know, it's just as absurd to think about that, isn't it? So, you know, really, this is what we have going on. We have, you know, vast numbers of people. If you widen the scope beyond North Carolina, you easily have thousands of people who have reported seeing black panthers. Can all of them be wrong? Mm. You know, are all of them mistakenly seeing, you know, the neighbor's house cat and thinking it's a panther? Come on.
Yeah. I mean, just how popular are black Labradors in North Carolina, David?
How popular? Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. So it is... it is somewhat absurd, you know, when you start looking at it from different angles. And you definitely get the sense that, you know, this is something that officials, they just don't want to deal with it. And I honestly don't think they ever will until they're forced to, you know, until somebody rolls into some small little town with a, you know, a bona fide Black Panther that they've shot or caught or found, you know, somewhere. And, you know, they say, here it is. How do we explain this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it, for me as well, a prime example of a similar creature is the wolverine, because wolverines are very reclusive, hardly ever caught on film, as far as I'm aware, David. And yet, we're fully aware that wolverines exist, but how many times have people actually seen them? I mean, I can't think of more than a handful of people that I've ever seen interviewed or discussed the Wolverine seeing one in real life. So once again, we're dealing about a species of animal, cat, that are known for being sneaky, reclusive, shy away from human contact. And North Carolina, along with many other states, has wonderful ranges of forest and woodland, which would be easy for anything to just disappear into.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And as you refer to there, you mentioned bobcats, which I think is a good lead to the next case that we need to discuss, because there's a little bit of mystery cat attached to this, depending on how much you look into it. And that's the infamous case of the Beast of Bladenboro, which appears one of those wonderful stories where something just appears from absolutely nowhere to terrorize a small town, which even in this modern era, David, I think the population's essentially just doubled. It's not much. It's less than 2,000, I believe.
Yeah, it's a very small town.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be a big village here in the UK. That would be pushing it. So once again, you've got a wonderful situation where we've got all the ingredients of witnesses, monster hunters turning up. What on earth is the Beast of Bladenboro?
You know, there's still not an answer for that, Paul.
Now, okay, there are let's opinions. Move on then.
there are opinions, obviously. Yes. It's probably, you know, I usually try to find a cryptid unique to this state, or at least one that has been cited a lot in that particular state for the cover. Mm. And it was easy with North Carolina because of the Beast of Bladenboro legend. And this is a story, I tell you, it's got so many of the right elements, you know, for just a crazy story. Mm. It starts actually in 1953. And a lot of people don't realize this, but the first sighting of what is believed to be the creature occurred not in Bladenboro, but in a small town called Clarkton. Now, Clarkton's about, it's just under 10 miles. It's like about 9 miles from Bladenboro. And it was just after Christmas. It was December 29th, excuse me. And a woman was alerted to something going on outside because her dogs were barking and making a lot of noise. And she decided to go out and see, you know, what was going on. Mm-hmm. She stepped out and saw what she described as a very large cat-like black animal. I love that. That was about 5 feet long. Hmm. And she said that when she spotted this creature, it quickly fled into the woods. So things were quiet for a couple of days. And then New Year's Eve, December 31st, a gentleman in Bladenboro has an incident where his dogs are attacked on the farm. And this is a brutal attack. He goes out and he's very distraught to find that his animals have just been kind of torn up. And he said that it was just, you know, a horrible scene. It was clear that it had been a vicious battle. It was it was late in the evening, somewhere around 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and the weird thing in this incident is that the gentleman's father wrapped one of the dogs up in a blanket. And later on at some point, this creature, whatever it is, they didn't see the creature at this point. Whatever the thing was, it came back and retrieved that dog. So it shows up again sometime in the early morning hours, and it kills the other animal. And this is sort of the flashpoint, because the gentleman, of course, reports the incident, and very quickly there's another attack the following day, January 1st. Another fellow reports an attack at his farm. And this time the story takes a little bit of a turn, because he claims that the animals were drained of blood. So, you know, we're talking the 1950s. And, of course, looking at this in modern times, you know, you can't help, when you start reading these reports, you can't help but start thinking, gosh, this sounds almost like chupacabra or something.
Yeah.
You know, because of the strange nature of it. But the attacks are very vicious, and they continue. So over the following days, other dogs are attacked around Bladenboro. And the police chief gets involved. Now, the police chief kind of fans the flames a little bit, because he reports that the animals are drained of blood.
Yeah.
And he has a vet look at the animals, and they're trying to determine what kind of creature has attacked these poor dogs. The police chief is not really interested in waiting to find out what he's dealing with. He gets some guys together, and he goes out to try to hunt this animal down. Well, it gets even more dramatic, shall we say, because by the 4th of the month, the newspaper in Wilmington catches wind of the story, and they report it. The other media sources jump on it. Now, at this point, no one really knows how media got wind of this account. You know, was it that slow of a news day that they had to get something out of Bladenboro? you know, hard to say when you look at the early parts of the story. But what happens is the accounts start cropping up very quickly over a series of days. There are more attacks. There are more witnesses who spot this creature. Now, the problem is everybody seems to describe it slightly different.
Yes.
Some say it looks like a lion. Some say it looks like a panther. Some people describe this bizarre sort of combination of different things. You know, no one really seems to have a solid idea of what they're dealing with. Although in most accounts, it does indicate that it's some kind of a large cat-like creature. Then people start reporting that they're hearing this thing, making these weird screeching noises coming from an area just outside of town. The police chief continues to try to track this animal down. There are incidents that occur when the hunting parties are going out looking for this thing, but because of news sources getting hold of the story and spreading it far and wide, other hunters start showing up. So here we've got, you know, the early 1954, we basically have monster hunters rolling into town. Now, you know, maybe they wouldn't have called themselves that at the time, of course, but they were after, you know, what was quickly being called the Beast of Bladenboro. And at one point, while the number of hunters grew over the course of a few days to just a crazy number. We're talking about, first of all, Bladenboro is a very small town. In 1954, the population was, oh, it was just under 800 people. Okay. So by the first week, there were, by many accounts, about 1,000 hunters in town.
Yeah.
Looking for the Beast of Bladenboro. Residents said that they were afraid to go outside because, you know, picture the scene, night falls,
And your little town of less than 800 people now has 1,000 men roaming around with guns, ready to take a shot at anything that moves in the dark, anything that they think might be the beast.
Mm.
So people were becoming terrified for a whole new reason now. And it was that, you know, they were afraid of being shot by accident. These guys would roam. There was a swampy area outside of Bladenboro. They were wandering through the swamp trying to track this thing down. They had hunting dogs with them. They all had an opinion on what it was, you know. They were speculating it was a panther, a wild dog, a coyote. There were all these crazy stories that come into the mix. And, of course, we don't have time to go through all of them today. Yes. But, you know, there were a few crazy ones that came in the midst of it. There was a claim that one gentleman stepped in and said, oh, I know what the beast is. It's a German Shepherd. It's a mixed breed German Shepherd that I used to have that I called Big Boy, and I gave him away because he was too fierce. And,
yes.
You know, then there's these other stories that crop in. Well, at the height of it, the town mayor, Mayor Fussell, brings in Fussell, coincidentally, also owns the local theater.
Mm-hmm.
And, Lindsay, he brings in a movie called The Big Cat. That was, it's this old West movie about this cat that's, this mountain lion that's on the loose. And it just, it gets really somewhat insane. And, when you hear these tales, you get the sense that this drug on for a long time. But really, the frenzy only lasted a brief time. It lasted for all totaled, probably less than 3 weeks, because by the middle of January, they're talking about potential, explanations for the beast, to describe what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, the mayor is now getting concerned, as is the police chief, that the situation in town is just out of control.
Yeah.
So the mayor takes advantage one day because a gentleman rolls into town and says that he's killed the beast, and it's a bobcat. And they take this poor bobcat, and Mayor Fussell, announces that the beast is, we've caught the beast. He is. And they take this bobcat and string it up on a flagpole in town center and put a sign under it. This is the beast of Bladenboro. Now, they do this in order to call off the hunt, essentially, and to get rid of people. So after that, the hunters start trickling out of town, and things slowly return to normal. However, there are reports that crop up after that, and they're quickly kind of shut down and say, no, that's not, that's not the beast. We killed the beast. It's all over.
Mm.
In hindsight, when you look at the entire thing, you find some interesting points to the story. First of all, Fussell, it turns out, was the one who contacted the media to get them to the story. Obviously, he was hoping to get some attention for the town, and some good publicity, and hoped it would help tourism or whatever. Well, it certainly did that for a couple of weeks there. Probably not quite in the way he expected. I suspect he also made a nice profit at the time of from airing the Big Cat in a movie. But otherwise, the atmosphere had just become so carnival-like, and just so frenzied that they really had no choice but to shut the thing down somehow, some way. And that's what they did by claiming, oh, no, it's just, it's all over. It was just a bobcat, and it's done. So that was the main portion of the Beast of Bladenboro story. Of course, its legacy, continues even today, because there's still a festival that takes place in the town It's called, you know, it's named after the beast. And I was just, in fact, I was just in Bladenboro a few weeks ago, and people still talk about it. And, you know, they still remember the attacks. Of course, this is, it's not too far back in history, so there are still people who were alive at the time and remember the incidents and remember the craziness that was going on, and also remember that there were attacks afterward that have cropped up on occasion. And, you know, you talk to pretty much anybody in Bladenboro today, and they'll say, yeah, well, that, you know, that bobcat that they brought in the middle of January was not the beast. Not at all.
Yeah. I mean, one of the striking things about this whole scenario, primarily fossils claim that the bobcat was responsible, is that I don't think that anybody described seeing anything that looked like a bobcat in the first place, David.
No. No, not at all. And it was, you know, it was a swamp that this guy, this gentleman, caught the bobcat in. He actually nabbed it in a steel trap that he had set in the swamp. And this was, you know, it's a couple miles from the city. Obviously, you know, there were bobcats in the swamp area, but no one, as you said, no one had described this thing as being a bobcat. Everyone said it was much larger and much different in appearance.
Once again, it's one of those convenient solutions, it seems, David, that whenever we get a weird case like this, I mean, the only thing I was kind of expecting was someone would say, oh, well, you know, we had that circus train crash around here the other year.
Yeah.
One of the lions escaped or something, because that, once again, is one of those that's wheeled out in a couple of other weird incidents in the state as well, where people say, oh, yeah, there's been an accident, and it's just one of those. And yet, as you refer to, it seems as though they just ignored what happened afterwards, because there were a few other incidents and a few other animals were taken and killed. And it's almost as if they didn't want it to be continuing at all. As far as they were concerned, as far as the town was concerned, you know, you've got 1,000 gun-toting visitors. I know you refer to it in the book that a group of university students turn up with guns because they, yeah, 'cause they want the beast's head for their wall.
Yeah.
So clearly it had caught the imagination, because I would imagine people were coming from out of state, you know, coming up from South Carolina and Georgia and in from the other states as well, just to try and get a piece of the action, it would seem. And it's one of those where it seems to be one of the first modern monster hunts, David, as well, in American history.
It's definitely an early one. You know, we had a lot of these that cropped up in the 70s. Mm. With various sightings. I covered several of those, of course, in the Indiana book. And in other areas of the country, we've periodically had some of these types of cases. Mm. But this one definitely was an early one, you know, 1954. And it wasn't as, obviously, it wasn't a period when everybody was talking about Bigfoot or things like that. So this was somewhat of a unique thing. And there was, you know, for most people, there were tangible things they could look at to say, wow, this is, you know, this is definitely some kind of creature. There's certainly something going on. This was not, for instance, a set of massive tracks, you know, that just led off into the swamp or something. This was a case where there were, you know, physical attacks. There were all these animals that had been assaulted. There were multiple witnesses who had claimed they had seen the creature, who had heard the creature, and who had very, fairly distinctive sightings or encounters with the thing. So, you know, that also made it very unique, I think. And, of course, in modern times, if something like this was going on, we would probably have the potential to do so much further investigation. You know, we'd be able to look closer at the victims to see, you know, what kind of marks or indications or maybe even DNA there was. But at this point, you know, obviously, they didn't have that kind of technology. However, it did certainly catch people's imagination. And again, the media attention, you know, that hyped it so much. I think created a situation where many people decided they wanted to be, you know, the guy who nailed the Beast of Bladenboro, you know, once and for all, and had the trophy, so to speak. But that doesn't really happen because, you know, they usher in this poor bobcat and they say it's all over, you know. Get on with things. And I think that even during the time period, a lot of people didn't necessarily believe that, but certainly residents wanted the situation to come to a conclusion.
Yeah.
Because they had valid concerns about what was going on. And I think that, you know, because the hype was quickly squashed, there wasn't really anything for the so-called monster hunters to feed on, so to speak. You know, there weren't new reports coming in every day. There weren't, you know, articles popping up in the papers. So they kind of had to let it go in that sense.
Yeah. And it seems to be a creature that has this kind of hold over the area because, as we were discussing off air, David, my introduction to the Beast of Bladenboro is an episode of Monster Quest from about 2009, where it seemed that a very similar set of circumstances were occurring in the town of Bolivia, which I believe is also in the area. Not close, but close enough. And once again, that seems to be one of those situations where people living in the areas were having their dogs taken, you know, and we're talking about pit bulls and Alsatians. These are not what you would consider the kind of dog that would be easily taken by any kind of creature. Because I know often they say, oh, well, it's probably a big dog that's got out that's quite ferocious and it's that that's killing it. But the same with the Beast of Bladenboro. I know there was one particular poor victim, one of the dogs, had essentially been decapitated by whatever it was, which is a remarkable injury for a dog to sustain under any circumstances. And I'm not aware of a situation where dogs fighting ones ended up being decapitated, David, even if it's a rabid one.
No, I've never heard of such a thing either. There definitely is, you know, I do a whole section in the book called Legacy of the Beast because there are cases that have cropped up after that, in the years just after the initial Beast of Bladenboro frenzy, there were some other accounts that certainly sound just like the creature, whatever it is that we're dealing with. But then when you sort of fast forward, you know, quite a few years and go even into the early 2000s, you have these accounts that pop up. There were a series of attacks around Asheboro in 2004, I think. And then a few years beyond that is the incident you're referring to around 2007. There was a whole wave of attacks in Bolivia. Now, that's about an hour southeast of Bladenboro. So we're still in the same general region, and certainly for a big cat, you know, we're certainly in the same space. And I'm not saying it's the same animal because that's a lot of years in between. But what you do have is an intriguing pattern when you have something that shows up in the same region attacking in the same manner. So there were a whole series of attacks that lasted around Bolivia, brief time, and then whatever the thing was, it just kind of mysteriously disappeared.
Yeah.
At that point, you know, they found some various tracks and some different animals, not just dogs, some different farm animals were attacked. But just like the Bladenboro incident, it was never really any solid conclusion to the thing. Curiously enough, it cropped up a few years after that because I think it was 2012 or 2013 in that range. There were other attacks in the area. And, you know, this is something that, of course, the officials say, you know, oh, no, it's just, you know, it's a dog attack or it's this or that. And really, these are consistently unexplained attacks. And now they do appear to be, to me, to be some kind of a large cat. And interesting enough, just like we were talking about at the beginning of the program, we may be circling back around to this idea of panthers.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it's clearly a black panther, David.
Right. Yeah. which doesn't exist, so the whole thing is you know, imagination.
Well, yeah, I mean, and once again, like I say, As with the original incident in the 50s and the other ones, because I know the, I think, is the one in the 60s where it's pigs that, you know, rather large hogs that get taken down. And then you have reoccurring flaps. And they're all very short periods as well, like you say about Bladenborough. It's a very short period of time, which is a typical cryptid flap as well, David, regardless of what kind of creature. We occasionally come across these stories where something seems to happen over a 3 to 6 week period and then just disappears into the ether again, into the swamps of mystery, wherever it may be.
Right.
And this just seems to happen every sort of 10 to 15 years in this particular area. Like you say, in different, you know, maybe 100 miles away or whatever, but there certainly seems to be some kind of area that is attracting something that likes to take down domesticated animals of a variety of types.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, if you, you kind of have to look at it, if you really want to get to the bottom of it, I think you have to strip away some of the hype that surrounded it. And even modern representations, of course, they push the more, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, they push things like, oh, it's the vampire beast.
Yes. And,
you know, more sensational, aspects. I think Monster Quest, when they covered it, even called it the vampire beast.
Yes.
But if I recall correctly, they also came back around to the idea of a cougar being the culprit. And really, when you take away some of the hype and look at the bare facts, I think that that's what we're dealing with. So once again, the imaginary Black Panthers are striking, but this time they're doing a great deal of physical damage.
Yeah, yeah, because I remember in that episode as well, I think they played some big cat recordings to one of the witnesses who'd heard it when he was sat on his porch, and I think he identified a lion, which is one of those things that I know you touch on in the book as well, that North Carolina is one of those states where they've got a secret big cat population of exotic pets.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised how many places in the U.S. actually has that, you know, these illegal exotic pets. And of course, I think that a lot of explanation, I think a lot of these accounts that pop up around the country, the explanation is exotic pet owners who let them go, because they quickly realize, one, how large these animals become, and two, how much it costs to feed them. Because if I'm remembering correctly, you know, a tiger eats something like, what's it, 50 pounds of raw meat a day or something. It's kind of mind-boggling. And really, I mean, you think about the size of a big cat, you know, and in comparison to, you know, a small domestic cat, will eat, what, a tin of food a day, right? And so proportionately, when you carry that up and think, well, you know, this is a massive cat. It needs a lot of protein, a lot of food. So, yeah, you know, you're talking about, you imagine what that would cost at this point in time to feed one of those things?
Yeah.
So, you know, people are letting these animals go and turning them loose in the wild. And hence we get these random reports of people seeing lions and tigers and such wandering around the country.
Remarkable. I mean, it is a mystery that continues to confound us. Like you say, I mean, what are we, nearly 70 years on? And people are still talking about this weird creature. Wherever it was, wherever it came from, wherever it went, it seems to enjoy just popping back up, just to sort of remind people that, you know, I'm not gone just quite yet.
Right.
And one of the other aspects of North Carolina, which I think may surprise some people if they're not too deep into the world of Sasquatch and Bigfoot, David, is that North Carolina has a long tradition, going back centuries back to the Cherokee, of stories of hairy men and giants and races of strange creatures living in the hills and the woods around them. And I think, unless you know a lot about Bigfoot, or you've read a lot, because I know it's one of those states that even caught the attention of people like John Green back in the 60s and 70s when he was looking into some of the reports. Are you surprised that more people aren't aware just how prevalent stories about Bigfoot or swamp apes stories are in North Carolina?
You know, I'm not surprised, simply because I've realized over the years that when you talk about
Sasquatch. If you go back and kind of not think about the past 10 years with all the television and, you know, shows like Finding Bigfoot and things like that, if you go back prior to that, people just were not that aware of how widespread these creatures are. You know, you would say Bigfoot and most people would think, oh, Pacific Northwest, you know, the Himalayan Yeti. You know, you've got a few isolated things, maybe the Skunk Ape in Florida. And then occasionally a few other areas would crop up because so much work was being done, for instance, in Ohio, you know, and some regions in the north. But even today, you know, a lot of modern researchers, unless they've studied it extensively and read extensively, they're surprised when they start understanding that there's so many of these accounts in states all over the country. You know, this was, I had someone talk to me about the Indiana book, and they told me they were shocked that there were so many Bigfoot sightings in Indiana. And I said, yeah, I said, you know, there are so many accounts. I mean, easily I could have done probably a couple of volumes just of Bigfoot encounters in Indiana. And in some ways, the same is true in North Carolina. Now, North Carolina, you know, it's a little bit different. People don't, unless they're familiar with the state, they don't understand that it's kind of divided. You know, you have the western half of the state, which is very mountainous and has a lot of a lot of forest and a lot of regions that are more rural. Whereas with the kind of the middle of the state to the east, you have, of course, the larger cities, you know, Raleigh-Durham, and then you've got the coastline. So the thing is that there are so many pockets around the state that are just prime territory for these creatures. The Great Dismal Swamp, the mountains in the west that, you know, are just so rich in territory that doesn't see humans trouncing across it every day. And you take a drive back there and you quickly understand, wow, yeah, there could easily be tons of these things hiding back here. And as you said, the traditions go far back to the Cherokee, who talked about them all the way up into early period of settlement. And then you've got some legends that have stuck around, like Judah Kula. And then, of course, all the way up into the 70s when there was another whole string of monster sightings in North Carolina, and that was all centered around a creature called Nobby.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite cases in the world of Bigfoot, David, because primarily one of the best things about the whole Nobby, once again, it's over a short period of time, 6 months or so, is one of the prime witnesses is a gentleman called Forrest Price. And Forrest, I think, got fed up of people either telling him he was stupid or he was an idiot and he didn't know what was going on, because Forrest was one of those people whose house was completely off the beaten track. I think he said you had to walk 9 miles through the woods to get to his house. It was at the end of a dirt track, and people were saying, oh, well, it's somebody just having a laugh, mucking about. And he's like, well, why on earth would someone come all this way out, start shouting in the woods at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Right. Yeah, we've got a flap in the 70s it's from 78, started in 78 and it went into 79. And it really, it's really kind of interesting because the first reported sighting from that particular flap was from an 88-year-old lady who... Her name was Minnie Cook. And, you know, Minnie is living all over the country, and she gets up early one morning because her, once again, her dog has alerted her that something's going on. And she goes to look to see what's going on outside, and she sees what she describes as this dark shape in the pasture close to her house. It's about 50 feet away. And she just kind of, you know, stands and watches this thing, puzzling over what in the world it is. And she's thinking that, you know, is that the cow? Is it, you know, what is that? Well, and then it stands up on two legs. So she now realizes this is a bipedal creature, and it's staring at her.
Hmm.
Now, she was terrified at the sight of this thing, and afterwards, she kept a rifle with her anytime she went outside because yes. She was, you know, she didn't want to run into this thing and didn't know what it would do.
Hmm.
But the thing about her sighting is that it's kind of supported by some other sightings. There was a gentleman who was driving a load of wood not too far from Minnie's house, and he spotted this thing. He thought at first it was a bear because of its size, but he said that it was picking berries off of berry bush and eating them. And he said that it emitted this low growling or this low sound, and he was not too he was a little bit cautious of the thing too. So these stories, they quickly grow in this area. And again, you're talking about the country. That's one thing you really have to emphasize at these sites. You're talking about a rural area. People in these types of areas, they're not, especially during the time period, everyone knows each other. They're not, this is not a prank situation. This is not a situation where somebody, you know, buys a Bigfoot costume and decides to go have some fun and try to trick somebody. This is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And the accounts, they quickly flow in. You know, there's a pair of sisters who are driving in the area, and in the following January, they spot this creature. It's consistently seen around the area. There's a hunter who spots it. Now, he gave a good description of it because he said that it was somewhere around 6.5 feet tall and about 300 pounds.
Mm.
He described the face, which is interesting because this is where we veer far from anything that's like a bear. You know, skeptics jump in and say, well, bears can stand up. Well, of course they can. But, these people know what bears look like. And now they're seeing a creature that is not a bear. So this gentleman, you know, this hunter, he described the thing, and he said that this was definitely not a bear, that it didn't have a snout, that the face was flat and somewhat human looking. You know, he was absolutely certain that it wasn't. Now, the funny thing about this guy, Paul, is he was out poaching.
Yes, he was.
And he made a comment in the aftermath of this encounter, and he said something to the effect of, I don't know what it was, but I don't intend to go find out because and that whatever this thing is, it's cured me of poaching.
Yes.
So he mended his ways after his knobby encounter.
And I mean, that's one of the things, as you touch on there, David, people were told, oh, you're all wrong. Once again, these people that have lived here all their lives, once again, you're all wrong. You're all seeing a bear in January as well, which is an alarm bell anyway.
Sure.
Because I know bears do hibernate most of the winter. They will appear occasionally, won't they? You know, but still. And it's one of those where I've also seen one of those classic excuses whenever a Bigfoot flap occurs that somebody with no evidence goes, oh, well, yeah, it was some moonshiners trying to scare people away. And you're like, well, how can you scare people away from where they live?
Right.
You know, the excuses are often as a dafter explanation than someone coming forward and being brutally honest and saying, I don't know what's going on. Like, as you touch on with Minnie and her rifle, Minnie has that wonderful line where she says, I don't know what it was, but I don't want to see it again. This is an 88-year-old woman. You know, fair play to her.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it seems that, as we often see in these kind of cases, David, in an area, the locals seem to take Nobby to heart. They seem to quite like the fact that they've got a Bigfoot knocking about. He seems to become something of a local celebrity to them.
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, you go to the region, you know, and you still hear Nobby stories. And, you know, there's occasionally... the newspaper will cover, you know, potential Nobby sightings. And really, this is a regional
nickname for Bigfoot, obviously, because that's what, you know, as people are describing. But it's kind of interesting that, as you say, they sort of took it to heart, and, you know, people will insist, you know, just leave him alone. Don't, you know, don't mess with him. Yeah, he lives up there. He's up in the woods, and, you know, he won't bother you if you don't bother him. So it's a very kind of interesting regional take on these creatures, and and very much an accepted reality to many of the folks that live there.
Yeah, and I know when I was reading your book, how it's the reason I became aware of this Bigfoot in North Carolina Nobby was the gentleman who the outdoorsman who lived in the woods, who essentially ends up phoning the police because he had an encounter and he was worried it was going to kill his dog in about 2010, I think it was.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's Tim Peeler.
That's it. Yeah, Tim Peeler and his git stick.
Which, you know, that's in some ways is kind of a tragic aspect to that story, just because it became the video went viral because it got covered by the news.
Yeah.
And they sadly poked a great deal of fun at this guy.
Yeah.
Because of his simplicity, shall we say. You know, he's this old country guy, lives in a very rural area, and in up near South Mountains. And he did. He had this bizarre encounter. He called the police. In fact, the recording of the police call is available. As far as I know, it's still online. You can listen to it.
Yeah.
And you have to look at both sides of this thing. I mean, if you listen to the call and you think, oh, boy, this guy maybe has been cooking up some moonshine or, you know, something because of the way he's talking, you know, you really have to wonder. But then at the same time, you got to understand that this guy was handling a what he says is a very bizarre situation as best as he could.
Mm-hmm.
He claims that this creature that he describes as a Sasquatch says that it looked like a giant ape with a man's face, and that it was out in his yard, and he was afraid that it was going to get his dogs. So Peeler, he wakes up early one morning after hearing coyotes, and he goes outside to check on his animals. And when he does, he spots this creature, sees it come out of the woods. And he does. He has a walking stick. And he said one of the things that's kind of amusing is in the report, and he told reporters this. He says, well, I have a rough talking. And I said, you get. Demonstrates how he, you know, put this stick up and poked at this, you know, poked towards this Bigfoot and said, get out of here.
Yeah.
And, you know, the police responded to the call and talked to him, and you know, he was honest and repeated the story many times, in fact, about what he had seen. It became sad in that mainstream media caught on to the story. It was run on, gosh, like CNN and some of the other news networks. And there was a YouTube interview that was put out with Peeler, then it becomes kind of a joke. You know, it's not, let's listen to what this guy saw. What in the world is he describing? No, let's just, you know, poke fun at how he acts.
Yeah.
And that's the sad part of it. But, you know, it was interesting in that one of the law enforcement officers that investigated the case said that he recalled the Nobby stories from the 70s. And, you know, he wasn't necessarily sure what to make of it, but he was like, well, you know, he's doing his job and he's taking the account. Yeah, I mean, people in the area, the ones I've talked to are kind of mixed. A lot of them say, no, he saw something up there, and those things are back up in the mountain, and yeah, that's what he saw.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me as well, David, like I say, he's a very genuine person, and he's one of those where being interviewed by mainstream media was probably the worst thing that could have happened for him, because he does essentially end up becoming an object of ridicule, which I think is very unfair to him, because he didn't have to do this. And I think he was just genuinely telling people what had happened to him, because it's one of those where you think, well, he's got nothing to gain from this. And I know he was quite frustrated about the ramifications of this, because everybody seemed to do very well out of his story apart from him.
Yeah, and he didn't want publicity. You know, he was really quite bothered in the aftermath of the whole thing that you know, that resulted in so much publicity for him. And there was a later interview that was done by a magazine out of Charlotte magazine, in fact, regional magazine, that interviewed him, and he said, look, it was just something that happened to me, and you know, I was afraid, and I was worried about my dogs, and you know, everybody's made money off of this. I just wanted to tell the police and let them know what I saw. You know, that's really all it was about. So you strip away all the poking at him and everything, and it's an interesting sighting.
Yeah, very much so. Well, the thing about North Carolina experiences, there are two other Bigfoot-related stories I want to touch on, if I may, David. Mm-hmm. First of all, is Michael Green, the former tank commander, which is a hell of a resume for many things. Once again, that's one of those things where I saw the footage and had completely forgot about it until I read your book. And I was like, of course, yeah. That is essentially a guy who claimed to have had an encounter and didn't have a camera on him, and became so convinced by what was happened, he was determined to get footage of it. And he ended up setting up a lure to try and film it, and allegedly caught something coming in to help itself to a candy bar, I think he'd set up or something, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he caught some interesting footage. You know, it's one of those that really made the rounds. The guy, as you said, has a heck of a resume. Mm-hmm. And he was so determined after a personal sighting of a Sasquatch that he kind of dedicated himself to trying to get further evidence. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's weird that nothing more has really come from that. You know, in the aftermath, it's certainly an area that is high in the number of sightings. He captured the footage back in, 2009.
Mm.
And it's on thermal.
Yeah.
So thermal imaging. And what it shows is a humanoid image that, you know, it's just this, if you've seen thermal imaging, you know what these kind of things kind of look like. So this, what appears to be this very large figure, comes out from the trees and reaches out and grabs this bait that Green had left. And it was a candy bar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of other researchers have been very impressed with the footage. I think it's pretty fascinating.
Mm.
And, you know, Green himself, I mean, even he did an interview after capturing the footage, and he said, you know, I really don't care if anybody believes this or not. I know what I saw, and, you know, I know what I captured, and, you know, here it is. And, you know, it's... yeah, it's pretty crazy. I tell you, he put in a lot of time though, because he was constantly going out and researching the creature. And as you noted, his resume, my gosh, he was a tank commander in the U.S. Army. He was a He was a fraud investigator.
Yeah,
the chief fraud investigator for the welfare department.
Yeah,
and in the state of New Jersey, and he was, you know, his expert in forgery and all kinds of other things, and just the list of his credentials. You read this, and it's like, oh my gosh, you know.
Yeah.
And now, you know, now he says, I saw Bigfoot. And, you know, so what do you say to a guy like that? what do the skeptics say to a guy like that, rather?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, he's refreshingly steadfast, like you say, David. He doesn't give a damn if you believe him or not. He knows what he's seen. And as far as he's concerned, it's real.
Yeah, and that's all the more impressive for me, because that's somebody who, you know, at least by all appearances, he doesn't have an agenda. In terms of, you know, he's not trying to get a TV show, or he's not trying to, you know, do whatever. He's got a personal mission, so to speak, and he's gathering what evidence he can. And, you know, fortunately for the rest of us, he shares it.
Yeah, yeah, very true, very true. Now, this next one is one of those that's exploded since I was planning to do this show, David, and end up speaking to wonderful guests such as yourself. And I remember when I was doing my preparation and I was planning everything, this story broke. And I was like, this is crazy. Casey Hathaway, a three-year-old child, disappears in the middle of winter. It's freezing out. 3 days later, he's found by Park Services, I think, found him. And you think, well, fair enough, three-year-old kid, what a wonderful story, survived against the odds in these elements. However, the aspect of his story that made people sit up and take notice is the fact that he claims that he survived for 3 days in the wild because a bear looked after him.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you make of that, David? Because I know some people have said, oh, well, he created a fantasy to help him survive, which I find... Once again, it's one of those kind of explanations where children go through traumatic events. They're all around the world, David. And there are numerous children that get lost hiking or in the mountains or in the woods in the States. I've never heard of another small child claim that a bear saved them.
No, it's a heck of a story. Just all the way around, quite honestly. I mean, first of all, of course, the mere fact that he was found alive, you know, is remarkable. Mm-hmm. And this occurred, for people not familiar with the story, this occurred in January 2019, so 2 years ago. And this boy was 3 years old. He went missing from his grandmother's home. And he was with some other kids playing outside. And the other two children, there were three of them total. So the other two children went inside. They left Casey outside. And when the grandmother discovers that he's not in the house, she goes out and starts calling for him and looking for him. And a period of about, oh, I think 45 minutes or so elapses that the family itself is just searching for this boy, and then they call authorities because clearly something's wrong at that point. And the local authorities, they really they kind of go all out on this one. They've got a helicopter that has heat seeking tech that, you know, flying overhead looking for this boy. And as you stated, he is gone for 2 days. And at this point, you know, people are starting to think, well, maybe this is not going to turn out so good. But January 24th, a woman who's out walking her dogs hears a little kid calling for his mother. So she calls, she dials 911, and search team quickly arrives at the area, and they are able, the boy's still calling out. They're able to find him. They locate his voice, and he's caught in a bunch of thorns in the woods. So, you know, at this point, this kid is, you know, he's pretty kind of scratched up and of course, you know, and clearly been in the woods for a couple of days.
Yeah.
And he's very cold, you know, his core temperature is low. But the authorities take him in, they take him to the hospital, and they note that while this boy was gone, temperatures in the area had dropped as low as 17 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
This is a three-year-old kid.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of mysteries here, regardless of how you want to approach it or understand it. His explanation was that he had not been alone while he was in the forest, that he had been hanging out with a bear.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, cryptozoologists that quickly looked at this and said, well, wait a minute, you know, bear is not just going to take the kid in and
yes.
you know, treat him to berries or something. You know, what exactly happened here?
Yeah.
So it is a fascinating story. I mean, even, you know, some authorities didn't know what to think of it. There was one of the county sheriff, in one of the interviews, you know, said, I don't know what this boy meant. You know, I don't know if he meant that a bear was actually there and was with him, or if he just made it up. He said, but you know what? I'm going to embrace this story and for what he says it is, and be thankful that the boy's alive.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating account. And I think that, you know, when you go back and look at various tales of, you know, purported human Bigfoot interaction, we really have to question, was there some other element involved here that was more than just a bear?
Yeah, yeah. Like you say, though, David, even if you take away what Casey says, I can't understand how he survived at all.
Right. Yeah, that's the puzzle, isn't it? And, you know, you would think, well, if, you know, if we sort of go the other direction and say, well, let's assume this kid was hanging out with a Bigfoot. Well, then he may have had shelter. You know, mm-hmm. He may have had some warmth to a degree. We don't know. You know, maybe that's what happened. And maybe it was the Sasquatch that, you know, got him back as close to his home as he could.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I mean, it's remarkable regardless. It's a remarkable story and a wonderful end because, like you say, unfortunately, often stories like that don't have a positive outcome for anybody involved. So regardless,
right.
It was heartwarming, and I know the footage of the family being reunited is quite tear-jerking, actually. It's lovely to see.
And it's about a half a mile from where he disappeared.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's the other aspect of this as well, is, David, his family were shouting for him,
yeah,
looking for him. How far is a three-year-old going to go in 45 minutes?
Exactly.
In
and
winter.
All the search parties and everything else, you know, a half mile from his home.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot more to it. Like I say, even if you unpack the bear explanation, wherever the bear, Bigfoot, wherever it is, it's one of those stories that it just doesn't make... There's a lot of it that doesn't make sense, but thankfully everything turned out all right in the end.
Absolutely.
Marvellous. Right, I can't let you go before we talk about one of the wonderfully weird stories you manage to uncover, because every time you do one of these state books, David, you uncover a really weird story, and we were laughing before we started the interview proper about, we were talking about those very odd squids that that turned up. And this time you've got something else that seems a bit peculiar, which is the weird story about the Cameron Village sewer blobs. And once again, a fairly recent story, isn't it?
2009.
Yeah.
Is when this one occurs. And yeah, it's a very bizarre, it's a very bizarre thing. You know, you read this, and of course there's a whole different level to this one because it is so recent. You have a lot of media coverage. You have some video. You have, you know, plenty of experts who have weighed in from different directions, but no explanation for what this is. And, you know, it's almost I liked writing this one up because as I said in the book, you know, this is almost like something from a 1950s sci-fi movie comic book, because it's such a bizarre looking thing. Now this is, you know, you have to imagine this thing if you don't have an image of it in front of you. So we're talking about a blob that is kind of, you know, looks like raw meat. it's wet and it's kind of pulsating. And, you know, it gives you this sense that it's just waiting to leap forward or something, right, and kind of, you know, overwhelm you. And you just have to think that, you know, like leaving a slimy trail and making a really disgusting, you know, kind of sickening sound.
Yeah.
This is what was discovered in the village of in the area of Cameron Village, which is in Raleigh. And this thing was discovered when a routine check was being done of the sewer system beneath Cameron Village. They were running cameras down, construction company was, to see, you know, what kind of condition the system was in. A lot of lines had been built in the late 1940s. So they were expecting, you know, some level of wear and tear, and you know, just kind of inspecting to see what do we need to replace and how much work needs to be done here and so forth, when they caught this bizarre thing on camera. And the video was released, of course, it caused kind of a frenzy because, you know, no one quite knew what to do with it. You know, it appeared to be a living, breathing animal. There was quickly speculation on what it might be. It's suggestions that it was some kind of a slime mold. There were other experts that weighed in and say, oh, no, these are sludge worms. That are bound up in a cluster and are sort of working together. Ultimately, this is one of those things that, you know, really no one seems to have settled on an explanation, because I had two or three scientists that jumped in and said, no, it's this, no, it's that. And they all argued with each other and said, well, that guy's wrong because it's the, you know, it's a sludge worm. And, you know, inevitably in the midst of it, of course, you had videos and stuff cropping up online saying it's aliens, you know, or it's toxic waste that has, you know, become animated by radioactive material. And, you know, the part of the fun in looking at some of these cases, I think, sometimes is just the explanations that people come up with to try to try to figure out and to try to say that they've got the answer. But really, when it comes down to it, no one specifically knows. And the story kind of fades away. Yeah. You know, people just stop talking about it. And you have to wonder, you know, what do the people in Cameron Village think about what's oozing around below their homes?
Yeah, I mean, as you touched on there, when I read this again, it's one of those where I'd come across it when it first broke, because it's one of those where it gets shared everywhere, and it was one of those videos that went viral, David, and everybody, as you refer to, saying, oh, it's aliens, they're here. But it, as you touched on that, it really did remind me of something from a 1950s sci-fi film, you know, like Quatermass or something like that, this strange creature lurking in the sewers. And it was funny to see how many scientists were very quick to point out that the other scientists didn't know what they were talking about. And also, I think the lady who described it as being a slime mold essentially just then backed off and said, well, whatever it is, it's nothing to do with this council. Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
not our problem. Thank
that's
you.
Not our department.
Yeah, brilliant. That is passing the book in a fantastic example, I think, David.
Yeah, great story though.
wonderful. Well, David, it's a fantastic book, Monsters of the Tar Heel State, and another wonderful collection of legends and cryptids and witnesses from North Carolina to go with the preceding books. Where can everybody get hold of a copy, and what is next on your agenda, sir?
Well, the book is available on Amazon.com, of course. You can go to my website, eerielights.com, and there are links there also to all the books. Additionally, if you check, I do occasionally, when I have time, put some signed copies up on eBay for people to snag. And the website, eerielights.com, will have announcements of other projects and so forth. I just released a book a few weeks ago called Haunted Prisons. That's part of the Haunted series that I write with co-author Ross Allison. I have, about three more books already in the pipeline. And in fact, the next installment in the Cryptid State series is currently with the editor. I think he's about wrapped up on it. So that one will be coming in fairly short order. And I expect to be previewing the cover for that fairly soon, probably by the end of the month. So I know everybody, you know, people are always asking me, what state is it? And, you know, I'll just say that you'll have to wait, but I did find some fascinating legends once again to cover.
Fantastic. And a wonderful cover for Monsters of the Tar Heel State, as the whole collection seems to have, by Sam Sheeran. So is Sam doing the cover for this one as well?
He is indeed.
Oh, fantastic. I look forward to seeing whichever creature has caught his eye then, David.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's brilliant. I was going to say, your books with Ross Allison I do enjoy as well. I know we've not really touched on them when we've spoken previously, but I got a copy of your Haunted Lighthouses for Christmas.
Oh, yes, nice.
Fantastic. Another captivating facet of the paranormal is things like that. So I've yet to get hold of the prisons one, because that's a subject I'm very interested in as well. So I'll be once again spending my hard-earned money on Amazon, no doubt, David. But thank you as always for your time. It's a real pleasure. Thank you for making time for me as always. You're always very kind and considerate in arranging to speak with me. I will look forward to the new book, and I know for a fact we're probably going to talk about that in the next few months.
It's always good to chat with you, my friend.
Take care.
Okay, you too.